Hey, what is up, everybody, and welcome back to Mile Higher Podcast. I'm your host, Josh, and my lovely wife was going to be here today. You'll see her in the ads probably, but she's starting to really go through it here in the third trimester, not feeling so hot. It's very difficult to be comfortable sitting for a while podcasting, and so she had to bail out of this one. But she's going to try to make it to as many as she can. But, you know, she's in the third trimester final stretch. She'll be here if she can. And if she isn't, then just know she is going through it. So our thoughts and love to Kendall. But this episode is going to be on the 1982 Alpine Meadows avalanche disaster. This is one of the deadliest avalanches to occur at a ski resort in the U.S., but it's definitely a crazy story, a story of survival, also a story of tragedy at the same time. But also here with me, I'm not all alone. Of course, I've got Ian and Janelle here. What up, guys?
Good Hello. Afternoon, everybody, or morning or night, whatever.
Whatever time it is.
And I like that. But there's a really, really great documentary on this this disaster called, I think it's called Buried. And it won multiple awards, I believe, in various film festivals. Very, very well done. Highly, highly recommend you go and watch it to really get that first person perspective from a lot of the survivors of this event. But avalanches have always been something that I've never thought about being a Colorado. I'm not a Colorado native technically, but I basically am. But
no, we learned you're a. Oh no, you're not an Oklahoman.
No, that's the thing,
Oklahoma, bro.
I'm originally from Vegas. I'm a Vegasan.
You're a Nevadan.
Nevadan, but no, I've been in Colorado most of my life, and you know, been in the mountains many times. Have skied quite a bit, especially in my early days, and it's just something that doesn't really cross your mind when you're up there. I mean, Janelle is on the slopes this year. Did it cross your mind?
Oh, yeah. I think about it all the time. But you know me. I do be thinking about every possible worst case scenario. But
could I die today?
Uh-huh.
How would that happen?
Uh-huh.
You probably drive through the mountains thinking about, could a boulder break off of the mountain
and
fall on top of you? No, I do too.
Every single time
I'm driving. It happens for real.
Every time I drive through Eisenhower Tunnel, I think, what if this just collapsed?
Damn, Eisenhower.
That would suck.
I would say that thought has crossed my mind, especially when you're driving along and you see like the fence, this like
the wiring
mesh, like holding up the side of the mountain.
And the sign, like, that says falling rock. I'm like, so what am I supposed to do with this information?
Yeah.
You're warned.
Hey,
warned.
You might be hit by a rock. Anyways, good luck. No, but when I, which we'll talk about this a lot, but ski resorts purposely create small avalanches to try and avoid having a big one unexpectedly occur. And a lot of times when I'm up skiing, you can hear like them setting off the, I don't know if they still use dynamite.
They use some type of explosive.
Yeah, something.
Yeah.
But you can like kind of hear it. It just sounds like a big boom. And so I'm like, well, that's good. At least I know that they're protecting us.
They're hard at work.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since Colorado leads the nation in avalanche deaths.
Yeah.
And there was recently, actually there hasn't been one here this year, 2026, but last year I think there was.
Yeah.
One.
Yeah. It's very unfortunate and scary.
And it's something that just happens instantaneously, it seems like, you know, especially if it's triggered by somebody skiing across the mountain can trigger an avalanche. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of ways that it could just happen.
I always, you know, like the videos of pro skiers or snowboarders who are like bombing it down those, you know, they're not mm-hmm. ski resorts. They're like helicopters.
Just the side
skiing,
of a mountain. Yeah.
And there's like an avalanche following.
Oh, I have
them.
A video we'll watch later.
Oh, that just freaks me out, man.
Yeah. Because, yeah, they could die at any point. Not only just from skiing down the side of a steep mountain, but an avalanche taking them out, too. But the thing about the Alpine Meadows avalanche that's kind of different than a lot of other avalanche deaths, especially in the U.S., is the fact that this was a massive, massive slab avalanche that buried people, but also completely took out the ski resort and busted through buildings. Because the way that Alpine Meadows is situated is right at the base of these steep mountains. And it was something that I think they knew could possibly happen, but they never thought it would happen in such a massive way. I mean, this is absolutely insane. But before we get into the story of the Alpine Meadows avalanche disaster, we did want to share that Higher Hope's 2025 Impact Report is now available over on the website at higherhope.org/impact. We'll have that link below for you as well. But 2025 was an amazing year. It was really a year that we could just felt so much more confident in the work that we could do. The amount of people and organizations that we were able to impact was truly next level. And so the impact report is there to provide full transparency of what the foundation does, where the money comes from, where the money goes. It's all there. It's all in the report. You can see a lot of information about the individual recipients. In 2025, we did fund 37 grants, and we dispersed over $250,000 in grants, sponsorships, and community projects, which is amazing. And we're really proud of the work that we've done with Higher Hope. It's already beyond anything we ever imagined it could be, and we have high, high goals for it in the coming years. And thank you to all of you out there who just listen, support the show. If you've bought merch, especially, a huge thank you, because again, all merch proceeds goes straight to the foundation to help fund those sponsorships, projects, and grants. And just thank you for being a listener, being a viewer. You know, obviously by watching, listening to the shows, there's ads you hear, and that ad money is helping fund the foundation. So thank you guys for all the support with Higher Hope, and cheers to 2026. It'll be a big year. We're excited to see what we're going to do. With that being said, let's go ahead and get into Alpine Meadows and what was going on at the time. So firsthand, we have to take a look at the culture, the lifestyle, the slopes. If you've ever been skiing, snowboarding, you start looking at the employees, you start looking at the ski patrol people, and they're not always like this, but just the general culture of skiing, snowboarding is chill, bruh. You know, it's a chill place, and people are going up there because they love the mountains, they love to be out in nature. And also the exhilaration of going down the side of a mountain at rapid speed. I love it. I'm a snowboarder. I don't get up to the mountains nearly as much as I should. And I plan on, once my kids are a little bit older, to taking them up and starting to get them into skiing or snowboarding and really starting to enjoy a very, very fun hobby, but a very, very expensive hobby. It's skiing. Snowboarding is not cheap. And even working at a ski resort can be very, very expensive. Whether you're working at the ski school, ski patrol, or you do avalanche control, or you're just a lift operator, those who work at the slopes definitely turn it into a lifestyle. But that doesn't mean that the lifestyle doesn't come without its challenges, because these are rural, deadly locations where battling the elements is part of your daily routine. For many, especially those in avalanche control, that battle is waged with explosives, dynamite, and even artillery shells. Big guns are used at ski resorts. And at Alpine Meadows Resort in Northern California, which had a Class A designation for risk of avalanches, those protecting the mountain knew just how serious things would be if they let a big one come down. Because the thing about Alpine Meadows that's different than a lot of ski resorts when it comes to its avalanche classification is that I think they said that there's over 300 avalanche zones that they have to monitor and mitigate at this resort, which is far more than most resorts out there. So it's a lot to keep track of. And on March 31st, 1982, the worst case scenario happened. Perfect storm of all of the elements came together, and a 29,000 foot long wall of snow slab avalanche came roaring down the mountain, trapping 8 people underneath nearly 11 feet of snow, probably even more than that. But what's even more interesting is a story that led up to this. And the story that follows with this sort of ragtag team of ski patrol members in their 20s who all of a sudden went into a massive search and rescue operation in order to try and find their comrades. So in order to understand all this, we have to go back to the very beginning of Alpine Meadows and the culture of those who never wanted to leave the mountains. In 1960, the Winter Olympics were going on in Squaw Valley, which Squaw Valley Ski Resort, extremely popular resort near Lake Tahoe in Northern California. And while visiting the resort for the games, a man named John Riley noticed that while the slopes, they were well-maintained, this is a fancier resort, and it was focused on business and image rather than on the skiing itself. However, just on the opposite side of the valley, the terrain lay untouched, and John thought that this could be the resort for those who truly love the hobby. He's like, this is epic, epic grounds for some serious skiing and snowboarding. So in 1961, Alpine Meadows opened as the cheaper, more pure alternative to Squaw Valley. And soon, the community and employees within came to reflect those very values. According to Jim Plain, who ran the avalanche control part of the ski patrol, he said, it was the most fun job I ever had because there were just a bunch of young guys with a ton of testosterone. So I think that speaks for itself. Just a bunch of bros hanging out, doing bro things, you know, skiing, snowboarding. I guess for these guys are skiing, but yeah, I don't think ski patrol can be on a snowboard, can they?
I don't know. Yeah, you can't.
Can't like maneuver on a snowboard.
Which is fucked up. They should let us in. Let us in the crew.
Yeah.
Oh, you're a boarder too? I'm
a boarder too. I ride. Mm. I ride.
But they talk. In a room full of boarders. I'm a skier.
Sorry, bro. You're with the cool guys.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I can't ski for shit.
Have you tried?
Yeah. It was horrible. It was like probably one of the worst days of my life. I'm not even lying. It was horrible. I remember being like, I will never do that again.
Were you boarding already by the time you tried skiing?
So I tried skiing first, but I was skateboarding beforehand. Oh. So it was just kind of more natural to hop on a snowboard, I think.
Yeah.
Not having my feet together was just weird to me. And I like could not get it together.
Yeah. I tried snowboarding after I had been skiing for a long, long time. And I fucking hated it. But mostly because I was obviously horrible at it. And I'd be like, why am I doing this when I could just ski? And I know how to be good at it. Yeah, no, it's hard.
Yeah, I feel like if you don't have any previous like boarding skills, snowboarding can be literally hell. Getting up is horrible.
I fucking hated every second of it. I was like, why are my feet attached? This is so annoying.
And having to like undo
your that's annoying.
Bindings every time you get done with a run. And
I will say snowboard boots are legit. Ski boots fucking suck.
Yeah.
Like they are so uncomfortable and annoying. The best part of skiing is taking your fucking boots off at the end of the day.
Yeah, snowboarding boots you can kind of roll around and they're kind of more normal snow boots.
They say that skiing is easier to learn, harder to master, and snowboarding is easier or harder to learn, easier to master.
Mm, I'm still really bad at it.
Yeah, it's like, when does it become easy to master?
I'd like to learn, man.
I go off like a little jump and I'm eating shit. Like,
yeah, well, I was going to say, when's the last time you even were on a snowboard?
It was probably a couple of years ago.
Was it with John? Like when you guys went that tiny little mountain?
Was it Monarch? It might have been shit. That was a couple years
ago. That was a long time ago.
Was that like 5 years ago? Or, yeah.
I think that was like 2019, maybe even. It was before COVID, I think. Sorry. Yeah, I don't know.
Damn.
We got to get you on the slopes again, Josh.
Yeah, let's go.
I know.
Ski trip.
Yeah, let's do it. No, we should do a ski trip. That'd be fun. I'm sure I'm not the only one out there that first thing in the morning, maybe you're going to take that morning pee. Maybe you're going to just sit somewhere for peace and quiet. You know, you pop your phone out of your pocket and you start looking at it. And there's always that app that you're going to first thing in the morning. For me, it's Rocket Money. It's right there on my home screen. And I'm popping in there because there's something about seeing my Rocket Money dashboard. It's almost like it gives me this warm hug every single morning, letting me know that all is well in my family's financial world. And you know what? It is this sense of calm that overtakes me as I look at my financials. Everything is organized. All my budgets are in check. And I'm alerted to when paychecks are coming in or bills are coming out. I mean, it is the easiest, seamless way to manage your finances. It's an app I've been using for years now, and it's an app I tell every single person about, because if you don't use something like Rocket Money or Rocket Money to manage your finances and you're doing it manually still, you are spending way too much time and you're leaving too much room for human error to get your finances in order. And Rocket Money has made it easier than ever to connect all of your accounts, including your investment accounts. You can put it all in one place, all of the different checking and savings accounts. I mean, most of us have more than one or two of those nowadays. And so it makes it easy to see it all in one place. But best of all, they're taking all of your subscriptions, scanning your accounts, and listing them out in this beautiful little list. And then you can actually cancel a lot of those subscriptions through the app, and they do it for you. You just put in a little bit of information about your account, and boom, they go off and do the rest for you. It is extremely easy, simple. I couldn't imagine a world without Rocket Money anymore. They also can let you know if they can go and negotiate a lower bill for you, which who doesn't want a lower bill? Great, great features that they have. They give you personalized insights and regular reports, custom budgeting. You can categorize transactions. You get custom email text alerts. I mean, it doesn't get any easier than Rocket Money. So Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps find and cancel unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending and it helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings. We all love that. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster. Join at rocketmoney.com/milehigher. That's rocketmoney.com/milehigher. Rocket your money to the moon and beyond at rocketmoney.com/milehigher. But anyways, back to our lovely ski patrol over at Alpine Meadows. There was Casey Jones, who worked for the ski patrol alongside Jim, and they said their activities consist of skiing all day and playing with dynamite. I mean, what a fun job. There's no other job like it where you get to just do the thing that you already, like basically your hobby for a job, and then on top of that, blow shit up. Meredith Watson, who was the only woman on the ski patrol during the early 80s, said that the guys were a little behind the times. Not quite as progressive as she would have liked. And, you know, they were hanging up pinup girls, you know, there's some naked pics around and just probably just being guys, being gross, being degenerates. Just when guys get together, it can be a wild time. But good for her for sticking around. She was stuck through it. And, you know, a lot of them got the job. A lot of these guys got the job because the idea of blowing shit up is every boy's dream. You know, who doesn't want to play with dynamite and blow shit up? But Bernie Kingery, who's the mountain manager, and Bob Blair, who ran the actual ski patrol, they knew that having a bunch of rambunctious young people on their hands was no easy task. But they didn't mind because they were both totally in love with the mountains, and all these guys are in love with the mountains. So it, you know, you kind of have this brotherhood, this camaraderie going on. And I'm sure it was a ton of fun. I mean, you know, this job's a ton of fun for us. So I can only imagine if you love snowboarding and skiing and you get to just do that all day, throw in some explosives and some weed and alcohol. I mean, shit, it's a party. But this is also the time. Hippie cultural revolution came to the mountains, baby, and it stayed.
It stayed.
In most places, I'd say, instead of, there's like, if there's a ski resort that's like Vail, even Vail to some extent has that sort of vibe
Bit. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely, Vail's very like,
it's very bougie, but. Yeah.
But still, I think just like, at least in Colorado, I've never skied in any other state, but at least in Colorado, it's very like, loaded, like this. That's is sick. Fucking... light up a blunt.
Yeah, you're smelling weed.
A
usually.
Shooter of Fireball on the chairlift, maybe. You know,
but speak that's for all... yourself.
But that's also kind of like just Colorado in general. I feel like attracts.
That's
that
just going to the grocery store.
Yeah, I was just like, yeah.
So you've got kind of this hippie cult, and just like there's a lot of mountain music festivals and, you know, a lot of like jammy Grateful Dead music going on, is often, in these mountain towns, like up in Dillon at the amphitheater up there. There's a lot of like jammy bands that go up there and play.
Yeah.
Telluride, obviously huge festivals up there, but yeah, this all really, you know, really got started. You know, Grateful Dead is in their prime, you know, in the 60s. And
well, actually, no.
They're getting started, at least.
They're getting started.
Well, we're in the 80s now. We're in the 80s.
They're in their prime in the 80s. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, the time Alpine Meadows is around. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They're because
what a time.
Yeah, I mean, going to see them in Reno or in Cali, San Fran.
They were playing there all the time. That's yeah. for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, they rented out a bus to drive the entire Ski Patrol team to a Grateful Dead concert in Reno.
Lucky.
But Bernie Kingery, who is considerably older and not really tuned into, you know, what all the youngins are into, would often catch Lyft operators smoking weed while on the clock. And
which I don't, I'm not, what I, the fuck are you doing? You,
that's a kind of an important job.
Yeah.
That's
an important I'm job. Like, you need to be sober if you're going to be working on a fucking mountain, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. Save the smoking for after work. You don't need to be smoking. Like, it's probably kind of a boring job, I'm sure. But still, like, people's lives are, people can fall off.
Yeah.
Nothing's worse than getting run over by the chairlift because the guy's not paying attention, getting smacked
with
it.
That's a lawsuit.
Yep. So when Bernie would catch operators smoking a little ganja, he'd say, yo, what are you doing? You know, get your life together, you piece of, no. He wouldn't fire them, though. You know, he cared about people and he wanted to try to put them on the right path. And, you know, I think that says a lot about who he was. But for many, alcohol and drugs really fit neatly into the life of being in a ski town, ski bum. It's just kind of a thing. And they soon all became young alcoholics, according to some members of the ski patrol. Because it's like, there's not a lot to do. Once it's dark out and it's the end of the day, what else you got going on? There's not a whole lot. You're going to party probably with your friends.
Definitely.
So Alpine Meadows is a bit rough and tumble compared to the more precious and expensive Squaw Valley Resort. Jim Plain wasn't there to party. He's took his job very seriously because he understood the risk here, that there are people's lives at risk. People can die on the slopes in a lot of different ways, but there's always a looming threat of avalanches. He said that people saw him as a hermit, spending his days alone in his small woodsy cabin. He was spiritually a Buddhist and felt like he needed to be tuned into the mountain. He said he needed his mind to be quiet to tell if there were changes in the environment. And while he mainly kept to himself, he was beloved by most of the ski patrol. They said he'd give you an excellent dissertation on density, prediction, and speeds and the areas they should bomb to protect the slopes from avalanches. And according to many, Jim was an enthusiastic citizen scientist. Now, Jim explained that even though he had an academic background, he had a lousy experience in school and described himself as a nerd who was bullied a lot. Oftentimes, he'd hide out in the library in order to avoid his tormentors. But his entire family was full of analytical deep thinkers. His grandfather was the head of economics at UC Berkeley. His father attended UC Berkeley as well. And his siblings also followed in their footsteps. Jim was the only one in his family who said, screw college. He took a year off after high school and then became a snow bum. He knew that from a young age, if he went to the mountains, he'd never come back. He said his college was the Sierra Nevada Mountains, and his peers called him the Shaman of the Snow, which I think is such a sick title.
Sick.
And I think that really does a good job at describing him too. Like, he's so in tune with the mountain and the snow. And just kind of embodies this whole lifestyle. But Jim was taken under the wing of Norm Wilson, who had started the avalanche prevention program at Alpine in the 60s. Norm had learned from Montgomery Atwater. Montgomery, or Monty for short, is considered the father of avalanche science. In North America, was the first scientist to attempt to track and mitigate avalanche activity across the United States. Alpine Meadows is sort of a breeding ground based on the topography and just sort of the geographical layout of this area. It gets a lot of high winds, which drives the snow and deposits it at the top of the resort's steep ridgeline, which creates this snow fence. And the steep terrain creates a ramp for potential avalanches. And the climate, which is dictated by Lake Tahoe, which is a massive, beautiful freshwater lake, produces fluctuating temperatures that leave uneven layers of snowpack. The snow, think of it as a layered cake, and when one layer fails, so if you have this loose layer underneath this heavy snowpack, the entire section breaks off in like one big piece and starts flying down the mountain, which this is what the avalanche is. And with how Alpine Meadows is situated, every area, including the lodge and the parking lot, is in a danger zone. Which I'm like, why did they do that in the first place? Why'd they build it right at the base instead of giving them some room?
Well, I do believe, like, in the very beginning when they first built it, they real again, avalanche science wasn't really
a thing, so maybe they didn't know.
They just simply didn't know, especially when it comes to the parking lot. It's like, they eventually learned that it was dangerous,
but right.
When they first opened it, they're like, we don't fucking know.
So when they learn, then maybe close the resort and move it.
Yeah, figure some shit out.
Like, I get it. It's money, and it's what it comes down to in a lot of these situations is, like, whoever owns this resort doesn't want to spend the money to safely relocate it. So in the event that something happens, that they're not completely screwed.
Do we know what the average, this is so random, the average cost of a lift ticket was for that time?
Let's find out.
Because, God, everything is so damn expensive.
What is a lift ticket cost now?
Oh, a day ticket, even like a small resort, is like $200.
200?
Yeah, for just one day.
Wow.
Like, yeah, it's, and so that has me thinking, like, the amount of money these fucking resorts make. Obviously, it costs money to keep up with the mountain and stuff and the equipment, but damn, man, with like, it's like $20 for a burger, $200 for a lift ticket. A lot of places you have to pay for parking now. It's insane.
So on the high end in the 1980s, the lift tickets would be around $30. However, accounting for inflation, that's around $100 to $107 in today's money. So it's always
okay. So it's still been quite expensive. Yeah, it's yeah. Literally, a Keystone day ticket, one day, $206 right now. Insane.
That's crazy.
So they're raking. I mean, Vail Resorts is.
What does a Vail ticket cost? Like 400. That's why there's these like Epic passes, yeah. Right? That's like the best way to eat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, even those are like really expensive.
$600 or something.
Yeah, at least. I think the unlimited's like more like 800. Vail Day is 307 right now.
Jesus.
But like Vail Resorts owns
yeah
a ton, like half the mountains here. So anyways, it's just, it is an expensive sport, that's for sure.
It's yeah.
The gear.
It's more expensive than golf.
Yeah,
well,
I don't know. I don't know anything about golf. So.
Golf is pretty expensive too.
2025-26 Epic Pass launched at $1,051 for adults.
Oh wow, I've not seen it break 1,000 before.
Wow. I will say my dad, he's a huge skier and he works on the weekends. I talk about my dad like every fucking
day. We love your dad.
I love
Shouts
my dad.
Out.
He's a good guy. He does weekends. He teaches ski school. So
does he get free?
He gets free. He skis free. All of his family members get like $50 passes. And then he also has like 20 or so, like $25 vouchers.
That's nice.
Tickets. So it, like, I get for these guys, they want to ski. You work at the mountain. It's like a cheat code.
Oh, yeah. And tons of people do that now.
Right.
Who just love it. We'll just, yeah, work on the ski mountain, you know, during the summer or during the winter. And you're on the mountain all the time. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it is not cheap, man.
So we talked about this a little bit too earlier, but how does one stop avalanches? Is there a way to do that? Well, the simplest answer to that is you make a bunch of small ones so that you don't ever get a gigantic one, which is what ski resorts are doing all the time to eliminate a massive one coming down when people are on the slope. So they do all that before the ski resorts open. And in order to start those smaller avalanches, best way to do that is to just blow the mountain up, basically just throw a bunch of dynamite at it, shoot at it, and create explosions, which will hopefully trigger an avalanche. At Alpine Meadows, the Avalanche Prevention Program had both a 75 millimeter recoilless cannon and a howitzer artillery cannon at the base. And this is because while in the 10th Mountain Division, Monty had seen how armies used artillery to create avalanches and bury their enemies, which this is legit. I think in World War I, there was a massive avalanche that was created that killed like 10,000 troops or something. Fact check me on that, but I'm pretty sure it was in World War I, I want to say. But it has been used in war, which it makes sense, right? That that'd be an effective way to combat in these types of conditions.
Yeah, White Friday during World War One, the most significant and the most, it was a series of avalanches in the in Italy, and the most significant avalanche struck the Austro-Hungarian barracks on Mount Marmolada, killing 270 soldiers.
God,
so it's so serious, man. And yeah, over a period of several days, avalanches in the Italian Alps overall killed an estimated 10,000 troops.
Holy shit.
Yeah, that's nuts. One of the things to keep in mind, especially with this particular event, is that when they're shooting off guns and cannons, usually they're in areas that are unapproachable to skiers, right? They're doing it in areas high up above where anybody would ever be. But during a blizzard with low visibility, obviously they really have no idea where those shots are landing or where the avalanches are starting, or if they're even triggering a small avalanche at all. So to make sure the snow is blasted away, the ski patrol busted out the gel dynamite. In their own words, OSHA was not omnipresent in those days. And the Alpine Meadow Ski Patrol would joke about how they'd throw a stick of dynamite, realize it's a dud, have a cigarette, and then collect the dynamite after about 5 minutes, just to make sure. I mean, that'd be bad if they picked it up and it was still lit. But here's a little example of how dynamite is used to trigger avalanches, a little clip. But Alpine Meadow's operation was extensive, sometimes firing as many as 500 shots a day amid artillery fire and dynamite. And another effective technique is known as ski cutting, or skiing across known avalanche zones to trigger smaller avalanches. And while it may be more precise than chucking dynamite at the side of the mountain or shooting artillery from the base, it's actually more dangerous because skiers sometimes get trapped in the avalanches that they create because it could break away and they could be on top of the piece that just broke away. This is actually a snowboarder who accidentally triggered a snow slab avalanche, but it just gives you perspective on how crazy this shit is.
What? Yeah,
good.
Rudy, okay.
Drop.
That is crazy, though.
Yeah, it's a nightmare, bro.
That is an expert level snowboarder that he was able to get across, get away from that avalanche. Because imagine going down with that avalanche. I mean, he's probably dead, honestly.
Yeah, just the force itself.
At the top of the mountain where it broke off?
Yeah.
Insane. So that gives you an example of what a slab avalanche looks like, too. It's just like a big chunk of snow that breaks off. But with these young people using high explosives every morning, Jim was worried that the group was becoming overconfident in its ability to fight back against Mother Nature. Hubris played an essential role in the training, yet they still felt they could do anything. Plus, with the ski patrol blowing up the mountain 500 times in the morning, the customers below were blissfully unaware of the danger that was above. But then in 1976, three people died in an avalanche, and earlier in the day, ski patrol told Bernie that they should close for the day because the conditions of the mountain were unsafe, they were too dangerous, but Bernie ended up keeping the slopes open, believing that, you know what, my ski patrol guys, we got it, we did a good job, we should be good. And unfortunately, that wasn't the case, and three people died. And at that point in time when this avalanche happened, they did not have a full-time avalanche forecaster.
I'm sure I'm not the only one out there that first thing in the morning, maybe you're going to take that morning pee, maybe you're going to just sit somewhere for peace and quiet. You know, you pop your phone out of your pocket, and you start looking at it, and there's always that app that you're going to first thing in the morning. For me, it's Rocket Money. It's right there on my home screen, and I'm popping in there because there's something about seeing my Rocket Money dashboard. It's almost like it gives me this warm hug every single morning, letting me know that all is well in my family's financial world. And you know what? It is this sense of calm that overtakes me as I look at my financials. Everything is organized. All my budgets are in check. And I'm alerted to when paychecks are coming in or bills are coming out. I mean, it is the easiest, seamless way to manage your finances. It's an app I've been using for years now, and it's an app I tell every single person about, because if you don't use something like Rocket Money or Rocket Money to manage your finances and you're doing it manually still, you are spending way too much time and you're leaving too much room for human error to get your finances in order. And Rocket Money has made it easier than ever to connect all of your accounts, including your investment accounts. You can put it all in one place, all of the different checking and savings accounts. I mean, most of us have more than one or two of those nowadays. And so it makes it easy to see it all in one place. But best of all, they're taking all of your subscriptions, scanning your accounts, and listing them out in this beautiful little list. And then you can actually cancel a lot of those subscriptions through the app, and they do it for you. You just put in a little bit of information about your account, and boom, they go off and do the rest for you. It is extremely easy, simple. I couldn't imagine a world without Rocket Money anymore. They also can let you know if they can go and negotiate a lower bill for you, which who doesn't want a lower bill? Great, great features that they have. They give you personalized insights and regular reports, custom budgeting. You can categorize transactions. You get custom email text alerts. I mean, it doesn't get any easier than Rocket Money. So Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps find and cancel unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending and it helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings. We all love that. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster. Join at rocketmoney.com/milehigher. That's rocketmoney.com/milehigher. Rocket your money to the moon and beyond at rocketmoney.com/milehigher.
So because of that incident, Bernie actually reached out to Jim Plain, and asked him to be Alpine's full-time avalanche forecaster. Now, Jim was only 27 at the time and was intimidated because he had seen what the mountain could do. I mean, he just went through those three people losing their lives. He knows how serious this job is. But at the same time, he was honored that Bernie believed in him. So he accepted the position out of respect, really. And I also just think that's crazy. Like, he was younger than us.
Yeah, that's like, wild.
That's fucked up.
It's a lot of responsibility.
So starting in this position, Jim now had to keep track of nearly 300 avalanche starting zones and basically had to build this program from scratch. He worked so hard that the charts he created back in the 70s are still in use at Alpine Meadows to this day. So just to kind of explain the hierarchy here, he was in a three-way partnership for mountain safety. Bernie was at the top, and he shared responsibility with Ski Patrol Director Bob Blair. However, just a rung beneath them was Assistant Ski Patrol Director Larry Haywood. Now, according to Jim, he and Larry, quote, were not the best of friends. Larry admitted that at the time he needed to make more money to support his family and that he, quote, liked being in control, which led to clashes of ego between the two men. Jim and Larry did not get along. However, under Bernie's leadership, they could often put aside their differences and work together as a team. Larry had become certain that the winter of 1981 to 1982 would actually be his last on the mountain. Jim himself at this point had 7 years under his belt and was, quote, on top of his game. But then in March 1982, the biggest storm of the century hit and it changed everything.
Because March 27th, Alpine Meadows was experiencing a ton of snowfall. In just 4 days, it had dumped nearly 97 inches of snow, feet on feet on feet, which resulted in a snowpack as deep as 20 feet in some areas, which here in Colorado, we'd love some snow up there in the high country for sure. It's a bit dry, a bit icy. It's been a weird year here.
We've had like no snow. It's really scary. Yeah. Because the fire season this summer is going to be
fucked up
really bad.
Yeah, very little moisture. Everything's going to be so dried out. Little snow melt. But it continues snowing up there at almost 1.5 inches per hour. On March 30th, Ski Patrol knew that they needed to get a bunch of smaller avalanches out of the way because they knew that with the way that it was snowing, that it would build up and there was a potential for a massive avalanche. A small team of Ski Patrol members, including Meredith Watson, was tasked with going to the ridgeline to bomb the area, although this would not be easy. One of them said, "It was exciting on the ridge with 100 mile per hour winds and bombs on our backs." But they soon realized that the terrain had changed entirely. The group split off and two members attempted to reach Poma Rocks, which is a known avalanche area, knowing that any sudden movement might trigger an avalanche and endanger their lives. So they made the tough decision to regroup at the base and instruct the artillery to fire on the location. However, it was a complete whiteout at this point. I drove through a whiteout the other night here. We had a little bit of a mini snowstorm here.
If you watched the Broncos game.
Yeah, there you go. The
Broncos and Patriots game, you saw.
Yeah, and then now it's all gone. That snow is nowhere to be seen here. It's back to sunny and dry.
Yep.
But yeah, it was kind of crazy. It was it was kind of a whiteout out there. I had to drive to my parents' house in a whiteout, and that was fun. But it's basically, if you're not familiar, so much snow and wind happening that you just can't see very far in front of you at all. And a lot of people, if you're driving, will just stop and pull over because it's kind of scary. You can't see a thing, and it just kind of feels like everything stops, you know?
Yeah.
It's so like a strobe sort of feeling. Yeah, I don't know.
I think the wind is what really gets it going bad.
Yeah.
Like it seems, you know, when it's snowing and not windy, it's not that bad. But at the second there's gusts of wind, it's sketchy.
They're firing off the guns, and they observed what they believed to be avalanche debris rolling down to the base. And they hoped that this was a sign that their shots had landed. Meredith and two other patrol members stayed at the ski patrol cabin at the summit, waking up at 4 a.m. to attempt to bomb any new locations. However, the conditions only got worse. They reported 87 inches of new snow by 5 a.m., with the winds that sounded like a jet engine. Jim said it was nuking snow on the way to work on March 31st. So even for these guys, it seems like these couple of days are just wilder than normal. This is a more intense snowstorm than what they had been accustomed to that they had seen. And so he entered the patrol room in the main lift building and saw Bernie there, trying to decide whether to close the runs or keep them open. Then when Jim looked at the wind chart recorder, he saw that the speed had reached 120 miles per hour. The maximum the reader could measure. It was also dripping red ink, which indicated that it had even broken the scales. Bernie called the general manager and told them not to open, then instructed the condo manager to tell guests to stay in their units. But even though they were closed due to safety, there was still a business to run. So they couldn't let the blizzard bury the ski area for when they did reopen. So the ski patrol got out there and kept bombing and plowing the area as the snow just continues to keep dumping on them. Meanwhile, the lift operators, including Sandy Harris, Beth Morrow, and Anna Conrad, didn't get the news until they reached the lift terminal building at the base of the mountain. Anna's boyfriend, Frank Yeatman, had been staying with the girls in the condo and had been going a bit cabin crazy while staying inside during this blizzard. And Beth eventually wanted to work as a ski patrol member. So she decided to go up and offer some, you know, support, lend a hand to Bernie and the other ski patrol members. Sandy pushed against it, telling her it'd be safer if she just stayed in the condo, but Beth refused. Then patrolmen fired the artillery. According to Jim, they shot the shit out of it. However, once again, they're just blind firing into this whiteout and they can't see anything. They can't see how effective the bombing or the shots are. According to Jim, they wanted to see avalanche debris, thought that they had seen avalanche debris, and then gave everyone a sense, sort of this false sense of security of like, no, I think we're good. I think we're seeing avalanche debris. I think all this work that we're doing is effective. We should be golden. Meanwhile, at the top of the mountain, Meredith Watson and another patrolman were sent to shoot another avalanche zone called Ward Peak. They tossed all of the dynamite with fuses as long as a foot. However, when one of the charges failed to detonate, they realized it would be very dangerous to remain in the area. So they decided to abandon it and make their way back to the patrol shack, hoping the artillery could strike this area from below. Meanwhile, recognizing the danger from the base, Jim and other members of the ski patrol drove to nearby Squaw Valley to close and clear the road connecting the two resorts. This would actually lead to legal issues later on, as county roads indicated that drivers were leaving an avalanche zone, when in reality, they were just entering the resort's own avalanche zones. So again, kind of a false sense of security there. People often didn't realize that they were actually in danger when I think most of us would think we were completely safe, right? People, including Dr. Leroy Nelson, had left his cabin with his friend David Hahn and his daughter Laura Nelson. And just like Anna and Frank, they were getting antsy, cooped up in their condo, and they wanted to take in some fresh air, get outside.
Plow driver Mike Alves last spotted them as they walked into the parking lot. Jake Smith, who is the upper road guard, was known as the court jester and an incredible person, and he noticed that down the road, amidst the gloom and whiteout, were two skiers, Anna Conrad and her boyfriend, Frank Yeatman. They had both gone stir-crazy inside the condo, and thinking that, oh, the ski patrol had already gone out, purged the slopes, decided to go do some cross-country skiing. Jim was like, nah, we're not doing that. He chewed them out and told them, get back to the lodge immediately. By 3:15 p.m., the area had received 103 inches of new snow since the blizzard began. This is insane amounts of snow. According to Jim and Larry, everything was moving. There's just something about the snow that day. It was kind of out of the ordinary. They said there was a tinkle sound to the snow. It felt electric, almost like it was alive. Eventually, Jim had a feeling of impending doom that was impossible to ignore. Right around then, Jake was sent on a snowmobile to scan the road leading to Alpine Valley, making sure no one else was on the road that connected the two resorts. At 3:38 p.m., Jim felt like he needed to call Bernie to understand the situation at the base. Bernie answered the call, and at first, it was a pretty routine conversation discussing what section of the mountain had or hadn't slid. Then he heard Bernie say, "Hold on," before he spoke with Anna. And according to Jim, Bernie sounded very upset. He told Anna, "You need to be gone." Then at 3:40, the phone went dead and the lights flickered at the Alpine Meadows condos. Then the ski patrol members heard static on the radio and the resort manager, Howard Cannell, spoke saying, "Call Don Huber. Get the dogs." Jim tried to reach Bernie again over the radio, but there was no answer. They called Bob Blair to ask what had happened, and he said, "I don't know for sure, but you need to get back here right now." Soon, word got out around the condos that something had happened at the base, and people started coming out of their homes to try and help. And the only way to traverse the terrain was on snowcats, and several visitors and patrol members just hopped on whichever snowcat passed by them, tied themselves on, and then headed over to the ski area to try to help and see what was going on.
So as Jim is approaching the parking lot, you know, he was expecting to see the usual sight of the lift terminal building and the lodge. Instead, Jim said, "Oh, fuck, the building's gone." So wood and lockers from the terminal building are just strewn over half a football field. The avalanche was so severe that it not only destroyed the terminal building and covered the parking lot, but it also damaged the lodge. It basically covered the entirety of the base. There were survivors, patrol members who were inside the terminal building when it was demolished. They told Jim what they had witnessed. First, Jake came on the radio as he was speeding to the terminal building on his snowmobile. He screamed, "Avalanche!" when Bernie asked where. All he heard was static coming from the other end. Then they felt the terminal start to shake. Randy Buck, who was another employee who survived, said they felt the massive air blast from the avalanche hit the building first. Then the massive wall of snow struck the building. It was 29,000 feet long and up to 11 feet high. Randy watched Bernie, quote, blow into oblivion and Beth totally disappear. The only reason he and others survived was that the counterweight on the lift actually blocked the air blast from killing them. So not only did patrol members know that there were several people trapped inside the terminal building, but plow driver Mike Alves explained that he had seen those three people, Leroy Nelson, David Hahn, and 11-year-old Laura, get swept away by the blast of snow. Once the impromptu rescue team spoke to survivors, they realized they had to locate eight missing people. So there's the three in the parking lot, and then there's Bernie, Beth Morrow, Anna Conrad, Frank Yeatman, and ski patrol member Jake Smith. Aside from the missing people, Jim's beloved German Shepherd had actually been in the terminal building at the time of the avalanche.
So at this particular point, Jim is just in complete shock. He didn't have a clear memory of these first moments, only thinking, is this my fault? Which, how can you not think that you're the guy there to help prevent something like this from happening? Meanwhile, Larry felt uniquely prepared for this moment. He organized both the volunteers and ski patrol, and they grabbed whatever shovels and chainsaws they could to tear into the terminal building. The volunteers were shown how to search in the snow, and what they were told to do is they would get a long pole and then poke as deep as they could into the snowbank, and they were told that if they felt this special feeling, that was them poking one of the bodies. Unfortunately, they were left with minimal equipment. The avalanche rescue cache was stored in the terminal building, which was now buried in lots of feet of snow. There was an additional rescue cache at the ski patrol hut at the top of the mountain, but Meredith and the other ski patrol members stationed there were told to stay inside, and it was too dangerous for them to ski down to the bottom.
I'm sure I'm not the only one out there. That first thing in the morning, maybe you're going to take that morning pee. Maybe you're going to just sit somewhere for peace and quiet. You know, you pop your phone out of your pocket and you start looking at it. And there's always that app that you're going to first thing in the morning. For me, it's Rocket Money. It's right there on my home screen. And I'm popping in there because there's something about seeing my Rocket Money dashboard. It's almost like it gives me this warm hug every single morning, letting me know that all is well in my family's financial world. And you know what? It is this sense of calm that overtakes me as I look at my financials. Everything is organized. All my budgets are in check. And I'm alerted to when paychecks are coming in or bills are coming out. I mean, it is the easiest, seamless way to manage your finances. It's an app I've been using for years now. And it's an app I tell every single person about, because if you don't use something like Rocket Money or Rocket Money to manage your finances and you're doing it manually still, you are spending way too much time and you're leaving too much room for human error to get your finances in order. And Rocket Money has made it easier than ever to connect all of your accounts, including your investment accounts. You can put it all in one place, all of the different checking and savings accounts. I mean, most of us have more than one or two of those nowadays. And so it makes it easy to see it all in one place. But best of all, they're taking all of your subscriptions, scanning your accounts and listing them out in this beautiful little list. And then you can actually cancel a lot of those subscriptions through the app and they do it for you. You just put in a little bit of information about your account and boom, they go off and do the rest for you. It is extremely easy, simple. I couldn't imagine a world without Rocket Money anymore. They also can let you know if they can go and negotiate a lower bill for you, which who doesn't want a lower bill? Great, great features that they have. They give you personalized insights and regular reports, custom budgeting. You can categorize transactions. You get custom email text alerts. I mean, it doesn't get any easier than Rocket Money. So Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps find and cancel unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending and it helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings. We all love that. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster. Join at rocketmoney.com/milehigher. That's rocketmoney.com/milehigher. Rocket your money to the moon and beyond at rocketmoney.com/milehigher.
And while they had begun the rescue operation with a lot of hope, that quickly dwindled as the hours ticked on. If the initial trauma of the avalanche does not kill you, you have around 30 minutes of air before you suffocate to death. The rescue dogs eventually arrived at 5 p.m. This presented a problem as well. Since the avalanche had destroyed the building, personal items like food, dirty laundry, and lockers were strewn everywhere. At first, the dogs didn't know where to look, and one of them even took a break to eat a mouse. Then, later in the afternoon, Lanny Johnson, he was searching the snowpack outside of the ruined terminal building when he picked up on a SCADI signal, which a SCADI is an avalanche rescue beacon. Other ski patrol members typically wear SCADI beacons to locate those buried in an avalanche as they transmit a signal when turned on. When Lanny's beacon went off, he assumed it meant he was standing above one of his friends. However, he asked another nearby rescuer if his signal was on, and the rescuer responded yes. Lanny just assumed that he had picked up the wrong beacon and moved on, leaving the area unsearched. Then, only a short while later, rescuers discovered the mangled snowmobile of Jake Smith at the base of the slope. When they turned on their beacons, they immediately picked up a signal. It took them a long time to dig out the nearly 11 feet of snow, but at the bottom of this hole, they found Jake's body. Lanny said, when you dig your friend out of the snow, all you can do is lock your feelings out. Then before the night came, they found the bodies of Dr. Leroy Nelson and David Hahn in the parking lot. Dr. Nelson's daughter, Laura, was still missing though. And while the rescue continued, the first aid room in the lodge was used as a temporary morgue. Larry, who had remained at Alpine Meadows for years, said that he remembered the smell of death every time he went back into that room. But as the sun went down, the rescuers were cold, they were wet, they're miserable. They decided it was time to call off the operation for the night. Still, Jim couldn't help but think, where's Bernie? He was our leader, and here we are having to do this without him. Jim and Bob Blair were the last two to leave the mountain. They loaded up the bodies on the snowcats and drove them to the coroner. Jim said that the force of the avalanche and low temperatures had frozen their bodies into contorted positions. Jim said it was unspeakable. Meanwhile, while rescuers returned to their homes and condos, Sandy still didn't have any idea what was going on. Her roommates Beth Morrow and Anna Conrad were still missing alongside Frank, and someone had told her, "Get yourself ready for this because no one's walking away." At the top of the mountain, Meredith could not sleep. At 2 a.m., she looked at the moon and she said, "It was mocking me because of the clarity." The storm at this point had subsided and she could see Lake Tahoe sparkling in the distance. She said it was a creeping, scornful moon. The next day, April 1st, the search effort resumed, and they theorized that for the avalanche to have done the kind of damage it did, it would have had to travel nearly 100 miles per hour down the mountain. Seeing the wreckage in this new clear weather, they just saw how truly devastated everything was. They said it was like a bomb went off. And when you look at the photos, it's insane. It's like they got hit by a force so massive that nothing down there stood a chance.
It looks like a war zone. Like really, if you pay, it looks like they were bombed straight up.
Yeah, and they're some of the other survivors were talking about how the steel I-beams in the buildings were making crazy noises from the impact of the snow that is some of the most disturbing noises they had ever heard.
Yeah, imagine how loud that was.
Yeah.
Oh my, I mean, not only obviously the buildings coming down, but the fucking force of snow just, oh, the storm.
Heavy, wet snow.
God.
The coroner also provided their autopsy on the three who were found the day before, and all three of them had died of asphyxia. However, with sunny skies raising temperatures, the layers of the snowpack also showed different temperatures, keeping the base a danger zone for more avalanches to occur. So Lanny and Jim knew they had to bomb the hills to protect the rescue area. And now they've got all this media down there. There's a lot more people down at the base of this mountain who have come up to help. And luckily, they had the media on their side now. And the local Channel 3 offered its news helicopter to the ski patrol. And they took him up. And then when the pilot asked Lanny what they were bringing on board, he shouted, "Dynamite." Here's a clip of the helicopter pilot recounting his experience.
As soon as we were on the ground, the ski patrol said, "We need to use a helicopter to dynamite the cornices to allow other rescuers to get in because there's still a threat of avalanches."
That's right. Livecopter 3 was being recruited for avalanche control. The ski patrol climbed in with one big bag of explosives.
We went flying around the resort, chucking out dynamite. I must have looked a little worried because at one point, one of the ski patrol members said, "That's okay, we've got a minute delay on the dynamite charges."
However, from the air, Jim realized how severe the avalanche truly was. He realized that the fracture originated from not one, not two, but four separate avalanche zones that all converged together to form a gigantic 29,000-foot wall of snow and ice. 29,000 foot, that's insane. After bombing the slopes from the helicopter, Jim got queasy. He felt like they still hadn't gotten the results he wanted, and he was worried that it was just a ticking time bomb at this point before the next big avalanche crashed into the base. So they headed back down there where Larry was now running with the search effort. They were still searching for five people, and even with a team of 120, they knew it'd be a massive effort. Just when they felt like the odds were low, they found another body. Laura Nelson was found in the parking lot near where they had recovered her father and David Hahn the day before. She was only 11 years old.
So after locating the three who were last seen in the parking lot, the rescue team then turned its focus to the destroyed terminal building. Just outside, they found the body of Beth Morrow. She had her SCADI signal on, and Lanny actually felt awful because this was the exact spot where his beacon had gone off the day before. Then, as they dug out the terminal building, Lanny saw this fuzzy thing amidst all the snow. After a few seconds, he realized it was the back of Frank Yeatman's head. Due to the force of the avalanche, Frank had actually been crushed to death. The rescuers were told that to minimize PTSD, they had to reduce FaceTime with the dead. Lanny had FaceTime with Frank's body and said, quote, his face was horrified and frozen. But Lanny had a job to do. So he stuffed down his anxiety and, while running on adrenaline, carried Frank's body to the snowcat. But now, with Beth and Frank's bodies recovered, the question remained, Where was Anna? I mean, she was there with her boyfriend Frank, and they still can't find her. Throughout the night, Lanny was shouting her name into the snow, hoping that somehow she could hear it. The next day, April 2nd, started slowly. The blizzard had resumed, and there was another strong avalanche warning, as now they couldn't even use the helicopter to bomb from above. However, they actually had the first sign of true hope. Jim's dog, the German Shepherd, was miraculously rescued alive from the ruins of the terminal building, which is incredible. I mean, the dog survived this insane, this force of God, really.
That's crazy.
And
what did the dog do?
I don't know. I only found it in one source recounting it, and it just said, they found the dog. What the hell? How?
Is there like any sort of, any more info?
That's all I
like,
saw.
Did the dog just come?
They must have just went over there and that came
there?
Walking out. Yeah.
Just came. I bet it was similar to like what happened to the other guys where they had, it probably had like something that blocked the air blast and like
That's
created
my
an
wonder.
Air pocket.
But like, how did it escape?
I think they just pulled it. That's literally all it said in the source was they found Jim's dog.
That's actually insane.
You know,
I'm pretty sure. Hold on, let me double check this. Dogs may be able to survive with a little bit less oxygen than humans, but still, their saturation levels range from 94 to 100%, like for normal saturation levels. So it's not like, because some animals like, I forgot which animal it is. I can't, it's some wild animal, but they require a lot less oxygen and like they can
go
survive without. But I don't think that's the case with dogs necessarily, like maybe a little bit more than us or a little bit less.
It must have
say.
Got itself like wedged somewhere yeah. where it was able to breathe.
Right.
And maybe had enough dexterity to dig itself out or something. That's crazy, though.
Yeah, it's fucking wild.
So still on the dog talk, one of the rescue dogs named Bridget had also alerted to a small triangular hole above what once was the locker room. Bridget was very demonstrative, and from the dog's demeanor, the rescuers thought that she had found someone alive. Roberta Huber, who managed Bridget, told Jim that Bridget had alerted to something big. But Jim was weighing a heavy choice. As the blizzard intensified, winds were reaching 90 miles per hour, and the sun was setting. He felt like things were getting too unsafe for the rescue team, and while he considered that the dog had found a survivor, they had been wrong in the previous days. I mean, they were eating mice and like running through dirty laundry, so it wasn't exactly a confirmed thing that Bridget had found someone.
I'm sure I'm not the only one out there. That first thing in the morning, maybe you're going to take that morning pee. Maybe you're going to just sit somewhere for peace and quiet. You know, you pop your phone out of your pocket and you start looking at it. And there's always that app that you're going to first thing in the morning. For me, it's Rocket Money. It's right there on my home screen. And I'm popping in there because there's something about seeing my Rocket Money dashboard. It's almost like it gives me this warm hug every single morning, letting me know that all is well in my family's financial world. And you know what? It is this sense of calm that overtakes me as I look at my financials. Everything is organized. All my budgets are in check. And I'm alerted to when paychecks are coming in or bills are coming out. I mean, it is the easiest, seamless way to manage your finances. It's an app I've been using for years now, and it's an app I tell every single person about, because if you don't use something like Rocket Money or Rocket Money to manage your finances and you're doing it manually still, you are spending way too much time and you're leaving too much room for human error to get your finances in order. And Rocket Money has made it easier than ever to connect all of your accounts, including your investment accounts. You can put it all in one place, all of the different checking and savings accounts. I mean, most of us have more than one or two of those nowadays. And so it makes it easy to see it all in one place. But best of all, they're taking all of your subscriptions, scanning your accounts and listing them out in this beautiful little list. And then you can actually cancel a lot of those subscriptions through the app, and they do it for you. You just put in a little bit of information about your account and boom, they go off and do the rest for you. It is extremely easy, simple. I couldn't imagine a world without Rocket Money anymore. They also can let you know if they can go and negotiate a lower bill for you, which who doesn't want a lower bill? Great, great features that they have. They give you personalized insights and regular reports, custom budgeting. You can categorize transactions. You get custom email text alerts. I mean, it doesn't get any easier than Rocket Money. So Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps find and cancel unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending and it helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings. We all love that. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster. Join at rocketmoney.com/milehigher. That's rocketmoney.com/milehigher. Rocket your money to the moon and beyond at rocketmoney.com/milehigher. Next, Lanny decided to dig the hallway. However, he realized that the locker room Bridget had alerted him to is nearly 15 feet deep in the snowpack. Jim, knowing that his training told him to protect the rescuers, made the most difficult decision of his life. He had to call off the rescue for that night, knowing there was a strong possibility there was a survivor trapped that they could potentially get to with the right equipment and time. Here's an archival news clip showing just how intense the weather had become. This is absolutely insane.
At the base of Alpine Meadows, people began pouring in from homes scattered over the mountain. I talked with one family that's been stranded for over a week.
Well, we got 14 people in one cabin. We're completely out of food. And my wife is pregnant with twins. We got 7 kids and can't get out of here, basically.
You also have some family up there?
Yeah, I do. I have 2 little boys up there, 6 and under.
These people are all stuck in one cabin.
Yeah. We're out of food. We're going down to town with the sled here, try to load up with food and try to truck it back up by foot.
About a 5-hour trip.
Even without the avalanche danger, the snow is so heavy it's beginning to crush cars and trucks and even some homes. These people have been trying to get out since Sunday.
We drove up last Saturday.
And you were immediately snowed in?
Uh-huh. Saturday night, snowed in. We had the car down there. We had to get it towed from down there. It was buried down there. We got it plowed out and everything, got it towed. And then it hasn't started since.
The Forest Service says they have never had this much snow on the ground in the Sierra this late in the year. They say they're surprised more big avalanches haven't hit. No ski resorts are open, and highways are still a losing battle for most road crews. Even the snowcats, which these areas depend on during the worst weather, are buried by the sudden huge snowfall.
So they boarded the hole and tried to get back to the residential area as quickly as possible. Larry Haywood said that it was frustrating to pull out, and many rescuers stuck around, hoping that the order was just a mistake. However, even though Roberta thought they needed to rescue whoever it was that Bridget had found immediately, she also understood that Jim was trying to protect all of them, the rescuers, because if something does happen, then there's nobody to rescue the rescuers at this point. So it was likely the right decision. He only had the word of a dog, also, that someone was down there. Dogs are pretty good. Dogs got good noses, and there's a reason they're used for avalanche rescuing. However, as most people returned home, this would be the first time they were given space to truly think through and just process what had just happened to them, this traumatic event. Bill Davis, Jake's best friend, reacted emotionally. It was like losing a brother. And Sandy had to keep Anna's family informed on the situation. They called and asked, is Anna there? And Sandy said she was. They wondered if Frank was there. And then her voice cracked. She couldn't imagine being a 22-year-old having to tell someone's parents that they were probably dead. Sandy said, I didn't want it to be me. And on April 3rd, the rescue operation had to contend with 133 inches of new snow that the blizzard had brought in. And because of it, they had to postpone the search once more. And instead, they attended Jake's funeral. It was the first time that Larry had felt the emotions of losing someone, so obviously took it very hard. He said, I wasn't an empathetic young man, and he felt a mix of depression and futility. Bob Blair said, I just hate to fucking lose. And then April 4th came around, and it just snowed and snowed and snowed with 149 new inches. They kept trying to stabilize the cliffs with dynamite, but once again, the rescue was put off until the conditions improved. However, that Monday, April 5th, was a bluebird day. Blue skies, clear, you know, sunny. And the rescue operation was able to continue. Roberta took Bridget right back to the hole, and once again, the dog alerted like someone was alive down there. Meanwhile, at the top, Meredith and the other patrolmen were down to a single carton of milk. When finally, a helicopter made it up there to pick them up, and Meredith was immediately put back to work searching the terminal building for more survivors, or just bodies. After a few hours, the weather picked up again, and Jim once again got worried that they'd have to call off the rescue. But just then, they pulled a piece of plywood and found a hand sticking up from the locker room.
Not only that, but this hand was moving. Meredith was in shock. She said it was like a ghost appeared. And this hand was none other than Anna Conrad's. So they pull her out and they're like, oh my God, how just shocked that she's still alive. And Anna explained that at the time of the avalanche, she was on the second floor of the terminal building. Frank was on the other end of the hallway, turning towards her just as everything went dark and she lost all awareness. She said, when I woke up, I was in a black hole. She could move, but didn't have a lot of space, only around 4 feet. She said the only pain she felt was from her head, but that her head hurt so badly, she just needed to go to sleep. She was woken up the next morning by the avalanche blast, and she once again remembered that she was at the Alpine Meadow Ski Resort. Trying to piece together what had happened, she surmised that the dynamite in the lodge must have gone off and just blown up the building. She didn't even consider the fact that a massive avalanche had just hit her in the building she was in. But Anna was getting super sick and had nothing to eat or drink for days while she was trapped below in this hole. She just knew that she needed to stay warm. And for days, she shouted until she could barely talk to the people searching above and was crushed when she got no response. She could hear Lanny shouting from above as the day turned to night. And so for the next 3 days, she just thought about her loved ones and mainly about Frank. She felt like she and Frank had created a fulfilling partnership. They weren't engaged or anything, but it kind of seemed like they were in love. There was probably absolutely more of a future there. And they had this intense passion that they shared for the mountains. The entire time that she was down there, Anna never remembered that Frank was with her when the lodge was destroyed. But she remained positive because she believed she could see Frank again and tell him she loved him. On Monday, Anna felt like they needed to find her that day because she was feeling very, very sick. She wasn't sure how much longer she'd even be conscious for. And aside from the lack of food, she had not had anything to drink for 3 days. And when that plywood was finally removed, some snow fell into the hole. And that's why her hand was outstretched, because she saw the snow and was reaching for it to try to get some moisture in her mouth. And Lanny said, Anna, is that you?
So right after this, everyone on the rescue team ran to see Anna because they wanted to, quote, touch the miracle. Lanny started jumping up and down and the team felt euphoric. One said, after days of frustration and anxiety and pain, we had a miracle. It was a flower of life out of all of this darkness. So here's actually a clip of the moments right after Anna was rescued.
Anna Conrad was conscious and smiling when brought by helicopter to Tahoe Forest Hospital in Truckee. She had been buried for 5 days. Doctors at the hospital are treating the 22-year-old Alpine Meadows employee. It appears she is in good condition. Rescuers say that she was talking at the scene when they uncovered her from the pile of snow. She was inside this shattered A-frame ski patrol hut when the avalanche hit on Wednesday. Still missing is the resort's avalanche expert, Bernie Kingery, who also was inside the building. Searchers have been hampered by continuing storms and snowslides. They were delayed getting into the resort until afternoon today, while crews dropped dynamite charges from helicopters to break loose dangerous buildups of snow. Squaw Valley and Alpine Meadows have been evacuated because of the avalanche danger.
Most of the residents still are being kept out of this area, and the search is to be called off late this afternoon as a new storm threatens to hit this area and the likelihood of causing even additional danger for more avalanche.
Actually, it wasn't until Anna was pulled out that she remembered that Frank had been in the building with her. She asked, what happened to Frank? However, the rescue team didn't have the heart to tell her yet. They responded by saying, Frank who? Then they finally told her that she had been trapped by an avalanche, which actually surprised her because that possibility had never once crossed her mind. Which again, just kind of goes to show how insane this fucking avalanche was, where she was like, no, this was a bomb. This wasn't an avalanche.
Experiencing the same symptoms of being in a bombing. Like, right. It's crazy.
So after this, she was airlifted out by a helicopter. The rescue team actually looked at where she had been trapped, and they realized that the lockers in the locker room had fallen on top of a small bench, which created an air pocket, and that's actually what saved Anna's life. And Bridget became the first dog ever to rescue a living human from an avalanche. Roberta said, Bridget got a steak that night.
Good girl,
Bridget. Good girl, Bridget. I know, Alice, can you do that?
Alice is like, yeah, I could rescue, of course. Look at her.
Uh-huh.
She's like, you don't want to find out what happens if I have a stake.
Yeah, you, the poop is going to be nuts, yeah. Bro. So Jim was astonished on the ground. However, he still felt awful because he had had no choice but to call off the rescue and assume that Anna had died. He felt like he had buried her for 2 extra days. Meanwhile, Sandy had just gotten out of Beth's funeral when she learned the news about Anna. She had been shrouded by so much grief that she almost couldn't believe that her friend was alive. Anna's parents met her at the hospital. Still, no one had told her what had happened to Frank. And finally, her father told her the truth. Anna said that she was so sick she couldn't even cry. And so Anna actually immediately did a press conference from her hospital bed. She said that she hardly remembered what they had asked her about because she could barely talk. So here's actually a later interview with Anna while she was still recovering from her injuries.
This is the first time since her rescue 2 weeks ago we've been able to talk with Anna. While weak from the treatments to save her feet from frostbite, Anna says she's feeling okay.
Yeah. I'm feeling, usually feeling pretty good. Yesterday I was feeling a little better than today. But I'm getting stronger every day, and I can tell that. It makes me feel good.
Yeah. Do you have a feeling about all that's going on around you? Does this scare you at all? We've heard about the inner strength that you have. How are you using that in the fight that you've gotten in?
Just trying to use it to make myself better. Just keep saying I can do it. I know I can do it.
Can we just leave the poor girl alone?
Yeah, that's how I'm feeling. Like, you guys want to do a press conference right after this shit?
That's insane. Like, get a statement from the family and leave it at that till she feels up to get on camera.
Right.
I wouldn't want to be on camera laying in a hospital bed hooked up to a bunch of machines and monitors. No, thank you. Especially after just sort of nearly dying.
Right.
Yeah, pretty wild. But the fact she's like pretty chipper and positive, honestly, considering all things, like, and it's sweet that she just wants to know about Frank. She just is like,
right,
I'm alive, that's all that matters, but I want to know what happened to Frank. And back on the mountain, there was hope that somewhere, after all, that their fearless leader Bernie had somehow survived. However, that hope was short-lived because just hours after Anna being rescued, Bernie's body was found buried in the rubble, and he too had asphyxiated. To this day, Jim still cries when he speaks about finding Bernie, our fallen leader. And if you watch that documentary, even in that, Jim gets choked up. It hits you hard, man. It's just, it really makes you feel a tiny shred of the sheer impact this event has had on Jim. He said it was fitting that Bernie was found last. It's like a captain going down with their ship, and his fists were frozen in a fighting stance. He's like in a ball like this. During the rescue, Lanny and the others were able to suppress their emotions, but now that it was over, they completely fell apart, and Jim couldn't stop bawling. Anna was still touch and go for several weeks while she told the press that she was getting stronger every day. The reality was much worse. She stopped breathing multiple times. Her kidneys and liver almost failed, and the frostbite on her feet were so severe that her toes looked like raisins. She wasn't allowed to watch herself on TV because her family didn't want her to see the reality of the situation. And eventually, Anna had to have her left leg and right foot amputated. According to Jim, there was a lot of self-medicating going on in the aftermath. And he and Mike Owls actually had survivor's guilt. Mike said, how come those people 40 to 50 feet away from me got it and I didn't? Jim simply said, why wasn't it me? And for Jim, he was tortured by his decisions and how people perceived him. Larry in particular was very critical, questioning his decisions throughout the entire rescue. And Jim said, maybe he's the guy in my subconscious to this day.
I'm sure I'm not the only one out there. That first thing in the morning, maybe you're going to take that morning pee. Maybe you're going to just sit somewhere for peace and quiet. You know, you pop your phone out of your pocket and you start looking at it. And there's always that app that you're going to first thing in the morning. For me, it's Rocket Money. It's right there on my home screen. And I'm popping in there because there's something about seeing my Rocket Money dashboard. It's almost like it gives me this warm hug every single morning, letting me know that all is well in my family's financial world. And you know what? It is this sense of calm that overtakes me as I look at my financials. Everything is organized. All my budgets are in check. And I'm alerted to when paychecks are coming in or bills are coming out. I mean, it is the easiest, seamless way to manage your finances. It's an app I've been using for years now, and it's an app I tell every single person about, because if you don't use something like Rocket Money or Rocket Money to manage your finances and you're doing it manually still, you are spending way too much time and you're leaving too much room for human error to get your finances in order. And Rocket Money has made it easier than ever to connect all of your accounts, including your investment accounts. You can put it all in one place, all of the different checking and savings accounts. I mean, most of us have more than one or two of those nowadays. And so it makes it easy to see it all in one place. But best of all, they're taking all of your subscriptions, scanning your accounts, and listing them out in this beautiful little list. And then you can actually cancel a lot of those subscriptions through the app, and they do it for you. You just put in a little bit of information about your account, and boom, they go off and do the rest for you. It is extremely easy, simple. I couldn't imagine a world without Rocket Money anymore. They also can let you know if they can go and negotiate a lower bill for you, which who doesn't want a lower bill? Great, great features that they have. They give you personalized insights and regular reports, custom budgeting. You can categorize transactions. You get custom email text alerts. I mean, it doesn't get any easier than Rocket Money. So Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps find and cancel unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending and it helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings. We all love that. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster. Join at rocketmoney.com/milehigher. That's rocketmoney.com/milehigher. Rocket your money to the moon and beyond at rocketmoney.com/milehigher. After the rescue was finished, Jim resigned from his position. He said he's just tired of being in the hot seat. And quite frankly, I don't blame him. I mean, after having gone through this and just being the guy.
Right.
At this extremely dangerous ski resort for so many years. And after this, he went into construction. It took him a while to heal and work through all this trauma. But Jim's best friend, Dick Tash, said that Jim went quiet for a long while. He climbed mountains by himself and sought isolation. Even Larry, who questioned Jim's decision at the time, said that he had done everything right in the moment. It was just an unprecedented situation. Still, Jim, if we remember, single-handedly built an avalanche control program at Alpine Meadows, and it's still the very core of the program to this day. Anna said that she was the good news in everyone's life for a few months, this miracle on the mountain. Her amputations took place in May, and she graduated from UC Davis in June. And then this is so badass, but she returned to ski the mountains the following December, and she was crowned the queen of the National Handicap Skiing Championships held in Alpine Meadows that year.
That's incredible.
Like, what?
People who, like, this reminds me of her name, Bethany Hamilton, who was right. attacked by that tiger shark, lost her arm, lost 60% of her blood, and then, like, less than a month later, went back out and became a professional surfer. It's right. just incredible what these people
Fearless
end
people.
Up doing.
Yeah.
And being like, I'm not going to let whatever harmed me win, like the mountain or the shark or whatever, you know, I'm going to go back out there and conquer it. It's so inspiring.
Especially when you lose limbs.
Yeah.
And to then go do the physical activity sport that you love just as good and go win championships and contests is...
It's incredible.
That's a special person. Because not everybody can do that. There's a lot of people who do the very opposite of that.
Right.
And
which I don't blame them for doing that either.
Yeah, right. Like, who knows how any of us would react in that situation. But the fact that she got right back to doing what she loved at the end of the day.
And relearned.
Yeah.
I mean, she is missing a leg.
And a foot.
And a foot.
Yeah.
That's
incredible. In skiing, where you need both of those.
It's unbelievable.
I also think it's important to know that this was... still at Alpine Meadows. She went back
to
the place where this happened.
Right.
That nearly killed her.
Right.
And killed her friends. Yeah, it's remarkable.
Meredith said that Anna's resilience allowed her to move forward with her life. It was a big inspiration for everyone else to help them heal and move forward with life. However, there was one more hurdle they needed to overcome. In 1985, the families of Leroy Nelson and David Hahn, who were the, you know, just the people there who were there for fun, for vacation, for leisure, they sued Alpine Meadows for wrongful death. Jim Plain ended up being sort of the fall guy for the resort. He was the one that was going to have to answer all the tough questions. The prosecution argued that the resort lacked adequate avalanche protection and that Jim's program was at fault. They pointed to the confusing signage, the signaling that the guns had hit their mark, and the fact that the parking lot was not labeled an avalanche zone, which I think these are all valid points, right? I think there is, people should have probably known the dangers that Alpine Meadows was hiding, and they should have known that they're not safe in the parking lot. I think that, I want to say, I'm like jogging my memory now, but there's definitely a Colorado ski resort where I'm pretty sure it might even be A Basin, because A Basin, I did a little research, and Arapahoe Basin's is one of the resorts at higher risk for avalanches in the state. It's one of the top ones. It's like Silverton Mountain is another one, but A Basin, I'm pretty sure I remember seeing like an avalanche sign in their parking lot or something. I could be wrong, could be just misremembering things, but yeah, they should have had signs in the parking lot saying like, hey, this is an avalanche zone, you're not safe here, so if the conditions are right for an avalanche, need to get out of the parking lot.
Yeah, Arapahoe Basin is considered to have a high inherent risk for avalanche due to its extreme high alpine terrain, which much of it is over 12,000 feet and steeper than 30 degrees.
Yeah, it's steep there. It's super steep.
Yikes. Yeah, a large portion of the ski area is about 12,000 feet. Steep, open, rocky, naturally prone to avalanches. Ski Patrol works daily to manage risks in the open areas, but in bounds, steep, unground terrain remains high risk.
And that's just another resort. That's just another place where people go and have fun.
But on the other side of the arguments here, the defense maintained that while these storms were precedented, the fact that all the avalanche zones combined into this one massive wave of snow and ice was unprecedented. They had prepared as they always had, but this event was unlike anything they'd ever seen before or even knew was possible. The jury was deadlocked for several days. However, the judge gave an additional instruction to assess the actions of Alpine Meadows for the standards of ordinary care with respect to the avalanche risk in the parking lot. Because the parking lot was not a known avalanche zone before this event, the jury quickly found in favor of the defense. Jim wasn't at fault. Bob wasn't at fault. It was simply an act of God. And to this day, Jim still hikes Alpine Meadows to Jake's Peak, which was named after the beloved patrolman. When asked if he feels like it was his fault, he said, yes, certainly four elements of it. I realized it was a battle leading up to the avalanche that we weren't going to win. We just had to keep going and hope we win something. Alpine Meadows is still a Class A avalanche zone. Deadly avalanches have plagued the area as recently as 2020. In 2020, it claimed the lives of two skiers. Larry Haywood stayed on at Alpine and was the director of the ski patrol for 17 years, succeeding Bob Blair. And Anna, she's still out there skiing, taking her children with her now. She was a ski safety instructor at Mammoth Mountain and said in 2025, one of my biggest goals was to never make this incident my whole life. This wasn't going to define me. I wanted to make sure that I survived the avalanche fully, not just partially, which is just incredible. I actually was able to find a more recent interview with Anna, kind of recounting her experience. And, you know, as she says in the documentary, it's been many, many years since this happened. So some of the details have, aren't as easy to recall, but this is I think this clip is 9 years old, but this gives you an idea of kind of where she is today, with all of this.
No idea what had happened.
Really?
So the building was hit. I had amnesia. I did not know where I was when I came to.
Okay. So you had a severe concussion.
Severe. My head was very painful. Moving around to try to find a way out was extremely difficult.
You had no idea where you were?
Right.
Or what had happened?
Correct. or who was with me.
Okay. And what are you seeing? Can you see anything? Is it all black?
It's all black. It's dark. But I can feel that there's some snow around me, but I can also feel mostly debris around me. So the building has collapsed around me. I don't know where I am or what I've got myself caught in. And I'm just trying to find a way out. So I'm crawling around in the dark. Friday. So the second day, full day, I was buried then by 72 hours in the afternoon.
Okay.
But it was in the morning that they were searching.
Okay.
The next day, so day three,
right.
They blasted again.
Right.
They did what they could, but no patrol was allowed to come in because it was storming so hard that they were concerned that it was unsafe. And everyone, except for the handler and my parents, assumed I was dead. They didn't have any sense of urgency because why would they? Nobody had survived an avalanche of that length of time at this point in the United States. They had in Europe, there was one.
I don't think your parents didn't assume you were dead besides just hope.
They just didn't feel like, they felt they would have known.
She is truly impressive, man.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at the footage of her skiing, it's like, damn, I can't, I've never been able to ski.
Yeah, she
like
skis
that.
Better than any of us will ever ski. Ever.
It's insane.
It's awesome. I mean, in such a tragedy, it's, this was the one major win that came out of it, that she survived this, and she just has completely slayed at life. She's just absolutely living it to the fullest, still doing what she loves, out there teaching kids. Anytime you're on the ski slope, you're at risk for something to happen. I mean, the chances of an avalanche, what's the probability of being killed by an avalanche? I think there's probably a higher probability of like running into a tree.
Right.
Oh, for sure.
Skiing and killing your.
That's how most like deaths occur on a ski mountain is running into a tree.
Yeah.
Overall mortality rate for being caught in an avalanche is approximately 13-22%. If completely buried, the chance of surviving drops to roughly 30-50%. 93% survival rate in the first 15 minutes, falling to 21% after 60 minutes. Yeah, how about multiple days?
Right. Yeah. Which again, thank God for those lockers and the fact that she just happened to be in, because again, Frank wasn't so lucky.
Yeah.
Bernie wasn't lucky. And all the others weren't lucky, were completely crushed and asphyxiated by this avalanche. But it's not something that you think about every day, but it's definitely something you should know is possible anytime you go up into the mountains, especially in uncharted territories. There's a lot of people like to go do alpine skiing and heli skiing and things like that, and where they aren't mitigating for avalanches, and it's extremely dangerous. But it's just always something to keep in mind.
And never go alone if you're going to do that.
Yes.
Like, if you're going to go backcountry skiing, don't go alone.
Yeah, and get some type of beacon, some way to notify help if you get covered.
And a lot of people carry like little portable shovels too. But that can only
if you're
so much.
I mean, if you're buried in 11 feet of snow,
you're
not shoveling yourself out.
Yeah.
And shout out to the dog.
Shouts out, Bridget.
The dogs are amazing tools, man.
Mm-hmm.
In all natural disasters, it feels like they always help out big time.
Yeah.
But let us know your thoughts on this. Had you heard of this before? Have you ever been in an avalanche? Do you know anybody who's seen or experienced an avalanche? Let us know. But that is going to be it for us today. I will see you. We will see you next time. Till then, keep on taking your mind a mile.